This process swearing in attorneys and then by our investiture of our newest justice, Justice Sykes, on Tuesday. So you are the second set of oral arguments in this court. And our first case today is 99-0158BA, which is Radden versus the Board of Fire Examiners. Mr. Hildebrand, you represent the petitioner, Mr. Radden.
Thank you, Your Honor. All I can say is that for temporary quarters, these aren't bad. I wasn't expecting anything this nice, so I congratulate the court and whoever designed this temporary room. It's very nice. Well, I am here today to argue on behalf of my client, Terry Radke, who went through the bar admission examination process, and it's our view that the board made serious mistakes of fact and law in denying Mr. Radke admission to the bar. This whole case centers around an incident of plagiarism, which occurred back in late 1990 and early 1991. And I think the facts are fairly simple. I think they're really not in dispute as what happened at the time. But unfortunately, I don't think the board was very careful in the way it made its findings of fact, and it came up with the wrong conclusions of law. There are a number of cases, namely Sagansky, which is a recent case that came down after the briefs were submitted in this case, as well as Gaylord and Martin, where applicants have failed to disclose criminal conduct and have failed to explain criminal and ordinance violation issues and have omitted substantial portions of that type of thing from their bar applications. This, although the board relies on that line of cases, those cases simply are not in point here. We do not have a case of criminal conduct. We do not have a case where there was prior discipline. We do not have a case where there is any real problems at all except this one incident. And I think that what happened here is the board totally misinterpreted and misconstrued what exactly happened and Radke's explanation for it. First of all,
okay, let me just stop you for a moment. Yeah. Then is it your position that, see, the board, but aren't we, and we are dealing with the board, what is the standard for reviewing the board? Made findings of facts in effect?
The standard of review is the clearly erroneous standard, and under that standard, these findings are clearly erroneous, and I can get into that, but I think you have another question you wish to ask
me. That was my question, so when I listen to you, I have to think in terms of your view of the facts versus the board's view of the facts.
All right. Well, I will proceed to do that. At Appendix 1 and 2 of our brief is the board's decision, which contains the findings of fact. And in Finding 3C, I'll get to that one first, there's a finding that applicant minimized his conduct by saying that he did not commit plagiarism, but simply forgot to include the necessary footnotes. That finding of fact is not true. There is, what the board did here was they took a statement out of context, and that is in Radke's response to a board question on the matter. He says at Appendix A6, I admit and I have admitted in the past that I simply forgot to include the necessary footnotes in the paper. But on the previous page, which is at Appendix 5, he says, in the fall of 1990, I submitted a version of the paper to a number of journals, including the Business History Review. The paper was designed to be in the style of a public lecture. The version of the paper did not include several key sites to secondary sources in the bibliography and paraphrased several sources that were not quoted. And that is exactly what the professor from the Business History Review said. He pointed out, and you can look at appendix at pages 17 and 18, where he says that there were materials that were copied and were not footnoted. And so Radke's explanation is totally at variance with the board's statement here that he said all he did was simply forgot to include the necessary footnotes. This is a particularly outrageous thing, I think, where someone will take a statement out of context, and they did the same thing when you read the transcript of the hearing. What everybody says here is completely consistent. There was the copying of some things without noting that they were copied. And that's what Radke explained to the board. That's consistent with what Professor Tolliday said in his critique. Then the other thing I might want to add right now, the three cases that I referred to involved people who didn't take responsibility for their criminal conduct. Radke has always taken responsibility for this, and he did it from day one. And if you look at the letter he wrote to Professor Tolliday, he said, and that's at Appendix 19, he said, "I take full responsibility for my actions. I am ready to accept any of the penalties which the editorial board feels are due to me." He didn't run away from this, and he didn't deny it, and he didn't say, this isn't like the case where somebody was arrested and blamed the police officer for getting into a fight and all of that. So here we have a clear case of quoting something out of context. Now let's go to finding D, which is on A1 and continuing on to Appendix A2. Applicant minimized his conduct by stating falsely at the hearing granted at his request that there were two different versions of the article prepared, one with and one without footnotes. And then they go on to say that the article that he did submit to the Business History Review contained footnotes. There is no statement at the hearing or in any of these papers that Radke made that the article he submitted did not contain any footnotes. This is a blatant error.
Could you, and I'll
go on.
No, could you stay with that for a moment? I didn't understand what you said. This says that Mr. Radke had two different versions, one with and one without footnotes.
But that's not what he said. What happened here was...
What did he say?
He said that there was a draft that did not contain the necessary footnotes. What the board says is construing his testimony. What the board says, which is completely wrong, was that Radke testified that the article he submitted did not have any footnotes. And then they go on to say, in finding E, which is at the top of Appendix 2, contrary to an applicant's foregoing statements, the article actually submitted to the publication contained 46 footnotes.
Well, you can agree that his statement can be interpreted in at least two ways.
No, I don't agree with that,
well,
Your Honor.
I could say I submitted an article with footnotes, and half of them are gone. So I only submitted 10 out of the 20. So I submitted one with footnotes, but the necessary footnotes were not there, which is 11 through 20.
That's essentially what happened here.
So there were three versions of this manuscript then. One without any footnotes, one with partial footnotes, and one with full footnotes. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm not telling you that there was a version without any footnotes. And that's what the board... That's what the board is saying. Radke never said that.
Well, in sub 2 there, on top of A2, it says the essay submitted was, quote, the non-citation draft, quote, the one without the citations, without the footnotes, quote. Where is that quoted from?
I believe that... I believe that that's at page 62 of the record on page 17, on page 17 of the transcript.
Okay.
He said, I was working extensively on the non-citation draft, the wrong draft as it were, and I put all these things in there. But then on the, then he goes on to say, I omitted some key parts of the bibliography which said that that was the background to the paper in question. That's on page 17 of the transcript, page 62 of the record. He doesn't say in this testimony or in any other testimony that he submitted a paper without footnotes.
So they shouldn't be quote marks around the words, the one without the citations, without the footnotes. Is that your position?
That's my position. And again, the board is doing the same thing they did before. They're unfairly taking something out of context without reading the testimony as a whole, and it's unfair and it's outrageous.
Counsel, one of the responses set forth on page 14 of your opponent's brief to that, your argument is, look, granted, in the record there is testimony that would support the board's findings and also testimony that would contradict the board's findings. But then you rely, according to their argument, you rely on the standard of review, clearly erroneous, and it meets the standard of review. What's your response to that?
My response to that is what the board relies on is quoted out of context and is unfair and wrong. They can say, I make a finding of fact that Radke said, I simply forgot to include the footnotes. He made that statement, as I stated earlier, at Appendix A6, I believe. But then when the board says, well, we don't have to listen, we can take that statement in isolation and forget what he said two sentences earlier, that he didn't list these two quoted sources and that he didn't cite secondary sources. If this court wants to tolerate that kind of quoting out of context, then I would say that's your responsibility, and you have the power to do what you will. But I don't think it's appropriate for the board to take a statement out of context and then hang their hat on it as a finding of fact. It isn't fair and it isn't right.
Well, again, looking at, I mean, if I were you and I were counsel for Mr. Radke, I think that's the argument I would make too, Mr. Hildebrand. But the concept that people testify somewhat differently at different times, that there are shadings of meanings in what they say, is well accepted. And the court then can say, hey, look, here the board can say, that there's contradictory statements. And when somebody contradicts themselves, you take what you think is the correct view. I mean, it's a trier of fact of credibility here, in which and that's what the board's brief by Ms. Timberlake says on page 14. They say, look, 3DI is not entirely supported by Radke's hearing testimony. Testified that he had two forms, one with necessary citations and footnotes, one with a number of critical citations and footnotes missing. He indicated that, quote, he omitted, quote, some of the key parts, suggesting that a partial bibliography was sent to the journal. He testified, however, that he, quote, was working extensively on the non-citation draft, the wrong draft, as it were, suggesting there were no footnotes in the draft. The board's finding of fact is therefore both supported and contradicted by Radke's testimony. Because the finding is supported by some of the credible evidence, the court could affirm the holding under the clearly erroneous standard. Alternatively, the court could modify to reflect the conflict in Radke's testimony. You disagree with that?
Yes, I do. I don't think there is any conflict in his testimony. There's absolutely no conflict in his testimony. And if you look at Appendix 5 and 6, he said, the paper was designed to be in the style of a public lecture. The version of the paper did not include several key sites to secondary sources in the bibliography and paraphrased several sources that were not quoted. And I'll omit the next few sentences. And then he said, I admitted in the past that I forgot to include the necessary footnotes in the paper. Now, to take that statement and say that he lied about what he did, there just is absolutely no basis for that.
Counsel, are you stipulating that there was plagiarism here?
There was a form of it, yes. He submitted this article and he didn't include the appropriate footnotes, and he quoted things that should have been footnoted, and he quoted secondary sources that should have been footnoted.
I'm looking at the Board of Bar Examiners, June 11th, 1998 letter to Mr. Radke explaining why they're doing what they're doing. And I don't know, it's number 35.
It's Appendix 9.
Appendix 9 and 10, that's right. And referring then to Appendix 10, third paragraph in the bottom, it says, essentially, the reason. The board finds that your act of plagiarism, that's one reason. The next reason, the misrepresentation of your discharge, the next reason.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, where exactly are you?
Okay.
Page 10, A10.
Okay.
Third paragraph from the bottom on A10.
All right, thank you.
If the paragraph starts, the board finds. I don't want to go forward unless you're with me on this.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So it's setting out the, as I understand it, the rationale. The board finds that your act of plagiarism, one reason, comma, next reason, the misrepresentation of your discharge, next, the recency and the seriousness of the conduct, next, the lack of evidence of rehabilitation, the lack of candor in the admission process, and the materiality of the omissions are all relevant to the board's decisions. Now, of course, those come right out of chapter 46.03. Could you address those bases for its decisions? Number one, we've already indicated that there is recognition that there was a form of plagiarism. Next is the misrepresentation of your discharge was the next basis that they assert. Is there or is there not a misrepresentation of discharge?
There is not. I think the facts were on the table, and the question is, what do you call it? Professor Hevler and Mr. Radke both testified, Hevler by affidavit, to that. It all goes to a 10-minute conference, and Hevler had gotten this letter from Professor Tolliday, and Tolliday wanted to ruin my client's academic career. I think their testimony is largely consistent, but all my client knew was that he and Hevler had agreed that at the end of the semester he wouldn't pursue further employment. That's agreed. He wasn't discharged. He continued to teach, and then at the end of the semester, out of the blue comes this offer for further employment, which Radke assumed, and it turns out maybe wrongfully so, was done with the knowledge of the department chair. He turned down that employment because he had a book to write, he had to finish his PhD thesis, and besides, at most, he was earning $8,000 a year, and he couldn't earn a living, so that's why he answered the question the way he did. Once The board raised a question about it. Radke told the board what happened. And whether or not this constitutes a discharge for cause, the cause being plagiarism, we don't think that it does constitute discharge for cause. Because there was no discharge. There was nothing in the file. He wasn't given a notice. He wasn't disciplined.
Given, and I may agree with you.
So whatever you want to call it, that's what happened.
But my sense is that given the standard of review and the affidavit of the chair of the department, that it is an interpretation that arguably, with regard to this issue, I'm not saying the whole thing, but with regard to this issue, that they could reach the finding that he was discharged. I mean, according to the affidavit of the chair, they can believe it or not believe it.
Well, it's quite interesting, and I'd like to refer to the applicant's brief, which there is a statement in the brief that let me see if I can find it.
Maybe we can help you. What is it? The tenor of the statement.
Well, the board essentially characterized it somewhat differently than the discharge for cause in its brief. It just wasn't a discharge for cause. There's no paperwork to that effect, and nobody ever told my client from the university that he was discharged for cause. But I would like to follow up on this. No June 11 letter, that was a letter that triggered a hearing. And it was a letter written pursuant to 6.02, which says there's cause for concern or cause for further inquiry. So Radke goes to the hearing and he explains all this stuff, and then the board just gets out its rubber stamp and says we're doing the same thing we did before without considering any of the facts or arguments. And I don't have much time, but I want to say this. Focusing on one of your questions, it says, the lack of the materiality of the omissions are relevant to the board decisions. The recency and seriousness of the conduct, we're talking about something 8 years ago. The lack of evidence of rehabilitation. This is the only blemish on my client's career. There is no criminal action. There is no nothing. And they want to say that there's no rehabilitation. What he did with this article is he cleaned it up and published it. Then he wrote a book. Then he got his PhD thesis in. He got his PhD. He went to law school. Absolutely nothing, no blemish. And they want to turn this applicant down because of this so-called plagiarism issue back in 1990. That is not appropriate. If bar applicants are turned down for that, there'd be a lot of lawyers out there that wouldn't have their license. Nobody leads a perfect life. We have a deserving candidate here that admitted his mistake from day one, never sought to hide anything from the board, and I would suggest to you that no matter what you do, you give my client the opportunity to practice law because this is called for by the record. Thank you, Your Honors.
Since you're not out of time, but
okay.
I'm not in the office, you don't also have any questions. I looked at the Minnesota case that cited that dealt with plagiarism, one incident, law school.
Right.
And
which I think is more serious because that happened the year before he was admitted, but anyway.
Arguably, and I need you to respond to this. Arguably, according to the findings of fact and their indication of a recent issue, not the 1990, but what they say is stating falsely at the hearing. it seems to me that the board is suggesting it's just not the 1990 thing, but as they set forth, the applicant minimized his conduct by stating falsely at the hearing, that's in D, and then they say in F, the applicant stated falsely at the hearing, and then in G, they say the applicant stated falsely at the hearing, all of these highlighting new things. And my sense was, look, maybe it's the, you know, the aftermath and not the underlying 1990 offense. Can you respond
to
that?
Yes, I think that's part of it, but I would like to talk about F. It says, stated falsely at the hearing that the alleged plagiarism recited came from secondary sources. True, he said that, but it's, the statement is true. And then when, in fact, it was from two articles published in professional history journals. Well, just before, I have already read to you both from his statement, written statement to the board, and from the transcript where he talked about regurgitating these two articles and not footnoting them. So what are they talking about? They're just simply wrong. They're taking things out of context. There is absolutely no false statement at the hearing. He said he copied things and didn't footnote them, and he said that there were secondary sources which weren't footnoted. That's in both statements. How can this be false testimony? Unless you take half of a sentence and take it out of context, which I think is totally wrong and unfair. So that's how I would respond to your article, to your question, Your Honor.
How about sub G?
Well, that is the one error that Mr. Radke made at the hearing. He said that he told the journal in a letter of apology that he sent them the wrong version of the article. That statement was not in his letter. That letter came to Radke's attention. He threw away his file years ago. That particular letter, which is at Appendix 19, is the actual letter. Radke mischaracterized that letter when he said at the hearing that he told the journal that in a letter of apology that he'd sent them the wrong version of the article. He did not make that statement in the letter. But what he did say was that he apologized and that he was wrong and he was ready to take his punishment, so to speak. Now, I don't think that making a wrong statement like that about some event when you don't have the document, 7 years that occurred 7 years before, should disqualify someone or show that there's lack of candor in the process. And I also think that the board was very unfair to Mr. Radke when they conducted a post-hearing investigation and didn't give him the opportunity to explain. I hope I've answered your questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Karen E. Timberlake, Attorney Timberlake, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Board of Bar Examiners.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Karen Timberlake, and I represent the Board of Bar Examiners in this appeal. This Court has charged the Board of Bar Examiners with the important task of evaluating whether applicants for bar admission have the qualities of good moral character and fitness to practice law needed to assure, to a reasonable degree of certainty, the integrity of the bar, the competence of services provided by attorneys in this state, and the maintenance of high standards in the administration of justice. Applicants for bar admission bear the burden of demonstrating to the board that they meet this requirement and that the entirety of their record does not reflect deficiencies in honesty, diligence, or reliability. In this case, Mr. Radke's extensive plagiarism of a scholarly article, his failure to acknowledge the complete context of his separation from employment with UWM, and his repeated failures to acknowledge the culpability of his conduct in submitting a plagiarized article convinced the Board of Bar Examiners that it could not certify Mr. Radke's character and fitness to this court. The board's decision should be affirmed because its findings of fact are supported by ample evidence in the record, and its legal conclusions are supported by the facts found. The court has asked Mr. Radke's counsel a number of questions about the inferences that the board drew from the facts that it found. And Mr. Radke asserts throughout these proceedings that the court does not owe deference to inferences drawn from facts found. The board would urge the court, rather, to hold that, in fact, both the board's findings of fact and inferences drawn from those facts are entitled to deference and are entitled to be reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. The board's task is to provide this court with its best judgment about an applicant's character and fitness. In order to do that, the board must be able to gather all relevant evidence and must be able, as the court has noted, to resolve discrepancies in the evidence that the board gathers. The board must have the ability not just to find facts that are undisputed, but to make its best judgment about facts where there is some dispute in the evidence submitted. Both in the Martin case and in the Sagansky case, this court has reviewed similar findings of fact that are in fact inferences or conclusions under the clearly erroneous standard, and that is what should happen here.
Ms. Timberlake, I would like to take a theme that Justice Bradley started with at the end of the questioning. On Appendix 5 of the Mr. Radke's brief, that is his application to the board for admission, as I understand it, and from looking at the record. And he makes revelation there, right? He says he's his answer is, have you ever been dismissed? He answers, no. But then he has attached to, you ever been suspended, reprimanded, admonished, warned, censured, or otherwise disciplined? He writes, no. But then he has an attachment that explains 20B and explains 13A. 13A is check here if additional employment is listed on an attached sheet using identical format. And he says that his departure from the university was to get additional new employment opportunities. But he goes on to explain that when he was at the UWM, he had some problems, which he details, about this article. And on top of A6, he says, quote, the alleged charge of professional plagiarism stems from a communication about missing citations, etc. Right? Keeps going. And he has, in effect, almost a full two typewritten page discussion about the alleged charge of professional plagiarism and about his non-tenure track dead end. He doesn't use that term, but that's what I infer from this description. And then he explains how he was hired for another year, and et cetera. And then he then goes on to explain that he did write this paper, and I'm assuming it's the same subject matter as the one that was a plagiarism issue, right? You don't know.
That's what Mr. Radke says.
Okay. There's no other evidence, right?
That's
a different paper. Okay.
That's right.
And then he says it was in fact published by the UWM, and that he is trying to get this matter behind him. And in 1984, he tries to pursue a new career, and that he explains, and we all understand this, that he and his family have undertaken personal and financial sacrifices to accomplish this, and that he wants to put this behind him. And I assume, representing the board, that the board knows there are mistakes and does put things behind, allows people to put things behind them, give them a second chance, et cetera, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So after I read all that, and then the argument seems to me to be, hasn't he made revelation enough? And if he is the board angry at the plagiarism, which we accept for the moment, that it was, which was 9 years ago, and or is it angry that there wasn't full revelation on the application and the hearing? And angry is not the right word, but the inference to be drawn from not making full revelation is that someone is not truthful, has not accepted responsibility, et cetera. So what is it? Is it 91 or is it 98?
The short answer to your question, Your Honor, is that it's both. The board's decision is premised both on the underlying conduct, the gravity and extent of the plagiarism in the professional article, as well as on Mr. Radke's failure to acknowledge the full context of his separation from UWM and his failure to acknowledge his own culpability for the plagiarism. Let me correct what may be a misreading of the record in view of the way it's excerpted in the appendix. The material that appears at appendix pages 5, 6, and 7 is in fact an amendment to Mr. Radke's application that was submitted upon prompting from the Board of Bar Examiners.
So this was not in the original.
That's right.
Then how did the board, and maybe this isn't in the record, how did the board get on to this?
Mr. Radke, let me direct your attention to page 3 of the appendix. And this is an excerpt of Mr. Radke's original application. Mr. Radke, as are all of our applicants, was asked to recount his entire employment record. And in response to question 13, he indicates that he was employed at UWM. The question asks reason for leaving under subparagraph B, under subparagraph A. Mr. Radke's response is low pay, no possibility of promotion. Upon receiving this application, the board sends routine employment verification questionnaires. One of those went to UWM, and the response that came back from UWM was that Mr. Radke had been terminated, that he was not eligible to be rehired, and that he had committed a serious professional indiscretion, that being plagiarism in a professional article. It was at that point that the board, and I would direct your attention to page 33 of the record, not in the appendix, the board then wrote to Mr. Radke and asked him the following. The board has learned that your departure from employment at UWM may have been as a result of professional misconduct in that you were charged with professional plagiarism. Please provide the board with the complete details surrounding your leaving employment with the UW. It is at that point that Mr. Radke responds with his amendment, indicating that his departure from UWM was ultimately, in his words, the result of a decision to commit myself to existing responsibilities and the need to pursue new employment opportunities. The board rightly faulted Mr. Radke in that supplement to his application for not acknowledging that, in fact, employment is a two-way street, and from UWM's perspective, he was no longer eligible to be employed there. Mr. Radke certainly reports the fact that he had a meeting with Department Chair Hubler and that the department chair advised him that his employment was at an end. But the picture of that event that Mr. Radke paints is that Professor Hubler's meeting with him, in fact, had no effect on whether or not he could continue employment at UWM. Mr. Radke says, I decided after I met with the professor that I couldn't continue this work anymore, and so I decided to leave. Mr. Radke also asserts as proof that he wasn't discharged that he received a subsequent offer of employment from the undergraduate affairs chair. Professor Hubler, however, corrects Mr. Radke's interpretation of that event in his submissions to the board, indicating that the undergraduate affairs chair would have had no reason to know of Mr. Radke's plagiarism, would have had no reason to know that he'd been asked not to continue at UWM. And so while the board certainly doesn't dispute that Mr. Radke may honestly have believed that that subsequent offer meant more than it did, the board's job is to consider the entire factual record before it, and there was ample evidence in this record to support the board's finding that Mr. Radke was discharged for cause and did not, in fact, acknowledge the fact that UWM's perspective had an equal bearing on the reason his employment did not continue.
Now, would you fault the board's findings of fact, none of which, that is, as to the supplemental and the final revelation, are in the findings of fact? They are very clearly set forth in Mr. Hildebrand's brief. If they relied on the fact that he didn't make full disclosure, that's not here.
Your Honor,
I don't see it here.
The board's finding of fact that corresponds to this discussion would be 3B, which reflects that the applicant minimized his culpability and responsibility for his discharge by describing the reason for leaving as low pay, no possibility of promotion.
And that was in the first application.
I'm sorry?
The reference there is to the first application.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly
it. It can be read, I think, to the second one, but I'll check that again, the supplemental. All right. Yeah. Yep. It is on page A7 on the top. Okay.
An argument can be and has been made that, look, this is plagiarism. Admit it, it's plagiarism. 1990. Okay, he minimized why he was discharged. Or maybe it was this is the argument. He minimized why he was discharged. And maybe he minimized a couple of other things. Is this the kind of stuff of which a person should be deprived, be the cause for depriving them of their livelihood? So could you respond?
Yes, Your Honor. The purpose of this court's character and fitness requirement is to limit admission to the bar to those applicants who demonstrate that this court, that their colleagues, that the public who relies upon their services should have no doubt about their integrity, their diligence, their honesty, their responsibility. There's no question that the plagiarism in this case occurred a number of years ago, and that fact certainly could be, that passage of time certainly could be counted in Mr. Radke's favor. What is not in Mr. Radke's favor, however, is his conduct and his representations before the board. Mr. Radke, before the board, does not, in fact, admit plagiarism. He does not, before the board, admit that he committed a grave mistake against professional standards, which is the sentence that he wrote to the editor of the Business History Review some years ago. Instead, before the board, Mr. Radke engages in an effort to downplay the significance of this event. That attempt on his part may be perfectly understandable. It may have been motivated by the passage of time. It may have been motivated by his great desire to be admitted to the practice of law. The bottom line, however, is that the board did not have evidence before it, based on Mr. Radke's representations, upon which it could rely in reaching the determination that Mr. Radke understood and accepted the culpability of his conduct. It could not be convinced by Mr. Radke's representations that he had cured the apparent defects in his honesty, diligence, and reliability. Mr. Radke offers a variety of explanations for the missing footnotes in this article. He does say on a number of occasions that he forgot to include footnotes. He does say that he omitted footnotes to secondary sources, the implication, I suppose, being that secondary sources are not deserving of footnoting. He does say in his request for a hearing to the board that this should not be viewed as plagiarism because he was never charged with plagiarism. And he says at hearing very clearly that he had two versions of the article, one with footnotes and one without, and that he simply submitted the wrong version. None of those explanations hits the matter head on. None of those explanations reflects that Mr. Radke has done the sort of self-reflection and contemplation of the gravity of this conduct that the board is entitled to expect of applicants to the bar, and that this court is entitled to expect of applicants to the bar. In fact, the evidence that the board had was that this most certainly was a serious case of plagiarism. Even before the board obtained material from the Business History Review, it knew that the editor of that journal had contacted UWM to accuse Mr. Radke of plagiarism. The board knew that the plagiarism was viewed as sufficiently serious by UWM to cause the department chair to do what was, in Mr. Radke's own words, damage control. It knew that that allegation of plagiarism caused UWM to advise Mr. Radke he was no longer eligible for employment at the university. Once the board obtained the information from the journal, the evidence became overwhelming that this was, in fact, a serious case of intentional plagiarism. The material appears on 26 of 48 pages of the article, beginning on page 2, ending on page 48. Although the material was, in fact, drawn from secondary sources in the sense that this was not, these were not primary documents that Mr. Radke failed to cite, the two sources were not, as he testified at hearing, Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, The Saturday Evening Post, or their equivalents at the time period Mr. Radke was writing about. Instead, the material came from two scholarly publications by Mr. Radke's peers in this field. Mr. Radke takes issue with the board's finding that, in fact, Mr. Radke represented that there were two versions of the article, one with footnotes and one without, and there's been quite a bit of discussion already of that testimony. I would simply call the court's attention to pages 61 and 62 of the record, which reflect the questioning of Mr. Radke by the board chairperson, which prompted that answer. The complete context, Mr. Radke urges the court to consider the complete context here. The complete context of that response is that Mr. Radke was asked a question which went as follows, beginning on line 19 of page 61 of the record. You indicated that you had two versions of the article, one that had the footnotes and the other one that did not, and it was the subject of a lecture that you had done that fall, and Mr. Radke's response is yes. From that question and from questions that appear on page 62, the board certainly was entitled to conclude that Mr. Radke had testified at some point that he had two versions of the article, one with footnotes and one without. The importance of that conclusion is that when the board obtains material from the journal, it determines that, in fact, the article submitted had 46 footnotes. But again, as the board argued in its brief, there is other testimony from Mr. Radke in the record which should make it clear that, in fact, there were two versions of the article, one that had more footnotes than another. And the court is certainly free to modify the finding as it deems necessary.
Ms. Timberlake, the bottom line on your brief, that we should affirm the decision of the, let's see how you have it phrased, affirm the decision of the board. And when I look, all the court affirms its decision in all respects. When I look at the decision of the board, it says that the board declines to certify Mr. Radke, and that's dated December 21, 1998. So, Mr. Radke, we're almost coming on December 99, so it's been about a year. What's the procedure that the board expects that he reapply? Did the board give him any indication when it might consider the reapplication appropriate?
The board does not have authority to set the time frame within which an applicant may reapply, nor does the board have the authority to set the conditions that an applicant must meet before making that reapplication. Both of those decisions are left for this court's discretion. This court certainly has permitted reapplication in a variety of cases cited in both parties' briefs. In some cases, the court has required nothing more than the passage of time before an applicant may reapply. In other cases, the court has imposed specific conditions that an applicant must meet. So the short answer to your question would be the board did not express an invitation to Mr. Radke to reapply.
The board is free to do so, though, is it not? Is there any prohibition against the board doing that?
This court has held in a number of decisions that it is for the court to determine when and whether an applicant may reapply.
Oh, I understand that, but is not the board free to make a recommendation to this court in that regard? Or to take a position in regard to that?
I suppose that the board might have the authority to decline to certify and could make a recommendation to the court one way or the other, that the court would obviously be free to adopt or not adopt. In this case, the board did not do that.
And the board is not doing that through you at this time?
That's right. That's right.
Are you able to answer this question? If it was only, and I don't mean to minimize or maximize, but if it were only the plagiarism involved here, are you able to respond to the question if the board would still decline to certify?
I'm afraid I'm not, Your Honor. I think that the cases that were cited by the parties in the record that relate to plagiarism in bar admission processes demonstrate that a variety of courts around the country view plagiarism as a very serious matter. I believe it was the South Dakota court that said plagiarism by itself is sufficient to deny bar admission. Certainly the Minnesota Supreme Court has taken a different view and has found that a record that includes plagiarism and perhaps even some other misconduct was not sufficient to deny admission. In this case, I think a fair reading of the board's decision means that it's unavoidable to conclude that it really was the intersection of both the past conduct and the present representations and lack of candor and lack of forthrightness that led to the decision that the board ultimately reached. And I'm afraid I can't speculate as to what would have happened absent either one of those. Mr. Radke also complains that the board did not take into account certain factors in its Rule 6.03 that relate to its evaluation of bar applicants. He asserts, for example, that the board did not consider the reliability of the information that was presented to it in reaching its decision. The board's decision does not reflect an explicit discussion of the reliability of the information, but it should also be noted that Mr. Radke advances no argument that any portion of the evidence upon which the board relied was not reliable. Most of that information came from Mr. Radke himself. The balance came from the two chairs of the history department at UW-Lamb, and then the final evidence came from the business history review from its editor, Mr. Tolliday. So there really is no basis that this court could conclude that some of the evidence upon which the board relied was not worthy of that reliance. Mr. Radke also asserts that the board should have taken into account the presence of mitigating circumstances and the absence of aggravating circumstances in reaching its decision. While, as we've discussed, the passage of time in this case may well be viewed as a mitigating circumstance, the board was also entitled to conclude that the extent and the serious nature of the plagiarism was an aggravating circumstance. And it was also entitled to conclude that Mr. Radke's failure to be forthright and forthcoming in all respects before the board and during the board's investigation was also an aggravating circumstance. Finally, the board's rule obligates it to consider the number of incidents. Certainly in this case, there was just the one incident of plagiarism. Again, it was a serious incident, and again, it was compounded by Mr. Radke's efforts to evade that incident before the board. It should also be noted that the board has demonstrated in this very case that it understands the difference between a significant and an insignificant omission or error on an application. Mr. Radke made a variety of changes and corrections to his application, some at his own initiative, some at the prompting of the board, which had absolutely no bearing on the board's decision to deny certification. The board understands that applicants may make honest mistakes in completing their applications and that those should not be held against them, but the conduct at issue here and the representations of that conduct go far beyond that kind of mere negligent omission. Finally, I'd like to address Mr. Radke's due process argument and his complaint that the board considered information that it obtained after the hearing. It's important to note, first, that Mr. Radke does not assert any harm as a result of the information that was obtained after the hearing. Mr. Radke does not assert that the board was poised to reach a different decision, but for the evidence it obtained following the hearing. He also does not assert, as I noted a moment ago, that there's anything inherently unreliable about the information obtained, nor could he. The information obtained was his own letter to the journal, the article that he submitted to the journal, and two documents prepared by the journal editor himself.
Ms. Timberlake, doesn't it strike you as somewhat unfair, however, to take into consideration materials received after a hearing and then not provide an opportunity to respond to those materials?
It doesn't in this case, Your Honor, for the following reasons. The board's process is not in the nature of a circuit court trial. It's not even in the nature of a classic administrative agency hearing. The board's process is one of investigation. The board's obligation, as I indicated, is to gather the entire factual record and make the best possible judgment that it can based on that entire record. This court has held on a number of occasions that an applicant is not entitled to a hearing at all on his or her bar application as a matter of due process. Rather, what this court has held is that an applicant is entitled to notice of the grounds upon which the board intends to deny an application and an opportunity to respond to those grounds.
Well, isn't that the problem with taking into account materials after the hearing and not giving an opportunity to respond?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. First, the board sent Mr. Radke an intent to deny letter, which laid out clearly the grounds upon which it intended to deny his application. Those grounds were discharge for cause from UWM and lack of candor before the board, both as to the discharge and as to the plagiarism. The only thing that is added to the board's decision from that intent to deny letter as a result of the material obtained after hearing are some additional facts about the conflict between Mr. Radke's hearing testimony and the material that was actually submitted to the board. It is true that Mr. Radke did not get the last word in this investigation. Mr. Radke did not get the final opportunity to review the material that the board obtained and to offer his responses to it. However, Mr. Radke had three opportunities to advise the board of everything he knew, everything he believed the board needed to know about the circumstances that led to his separation from employment with UWM, and the details of the plagiarism and every reason in the world he could think to justify why that article was submitted the way it was submitted. In other words, Mr. Radke had a full opportunity to be heard. In no way was he denied an opportunity to present to the board his side of the story in this case. Mr. Radke simply did not demonstrate to the board's satisfaction that he understood the gravity and the seriousness of his prior conduct. By casting past events in the best possible light, in a favorable light before the board, he fell short of his obligation imposed upon him by the board and by this court's rules to be candid, to be forthcoming, to be truthful, to be complete in his presentation to the board. In addition, his extensive plagiarism, although it occurred a number of years ago, casts a long shadow. This was serious conduct, very indicative of dishonesty, of a lack of diligence, of a lack of integrity, all factors that the board should have considered and did consider. As this court well knows, attorneys in this state are entrusted with their clients' most sensitive and most vital matters. The legal system depends on attorneys being candid with their clients, with their adversaries, and with the tribunals that they appear before. It is not too much for the board to demand candor, completeness, forthrightness, and an unsanitized examination of the facts from applicants for bar admission. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Timberlake. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. my distinguished opponent explained how the board got onto the so-called plagiarism and termination issue. I would like to just put this into context. What happened to Radke? He was devastated when he went into that 10-minute meeting with Hebler. Hebler told him he probably wouldn't be rehired or wouldn't be rehired. Then that's all that happens, except several months later he gets an offer. He didn't know what was going on behind the scenes at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So he gets his bar application. He says, why did you, your reason for leaving Mark UWM? Low pay, no possibility of promotion. From his perspective at that time, that was accurate. Have you ever been suspended, reprimanded, admonished, warned, censured, or otherwise disciplined or disqualified, etc., etc.? He answered that question, no. That's on Appendix 4. So what happens is that the board, as my opponent says, makes its routine inquiry, and Professor Fetter writes back that says, Radke was informed, and that's at record pages 23, 24, informed that he wouldn't be rehired, terminated by previous chair. Has he ever engaged in fraudulent or deceitful conduct? Explained, the applicant's scholarly standing was compromised by an act of professional indiscretion. Not a word in here about plagiarism. So then the board says, okay, explain this. And Radke submits his explanation, which is at Appendix 5 and 6, and he tells about the article, and he says what he did. He didn't include the footnotes. He had quotations out of two paraphrased several sources that were not quoted. That's exactly what happened here, and that he did not include several key sites, the secondary sources of bibliography. That's what happened. What else is there? Now, when Justice Bradley, you asked me the question about what was he terminated for cause, I say the answer to that is so what? You know, we all know what happened. But the board's brief says, the record is clear that UWM asked Radke to leave due to his submission paper for publication that contained a substantial amount of plagiarized material. That is not termination for cause. We all know what termination for cause is. You have some kind of a hearing, and you get disciplined, and you're out. That didn't happen to you.
Is that true for a one-year appointment to the university? Where do you find that, Mr. Hildebrand?
I'm saying that Radke never was told that he was terminated for cause. There's nothing in his file. He was never disciplined. From his perspective, and then, of course, the board, and I think properly so, asked the question and then asked Radke to supplement and give his explanation, and he gave a truthful explanation.
I'm sorry, I put in Justice Bradley, you had a question.
Yeah. My sense was, I think it's page 7, reason for leaving. He puts low pay, no possibility of promotion.
This is on the original application.
This is on the original application. And at the end of that application, he, in his own handwriting, at the request of BPE form, says, I further acknowledge that any false, misleading, or evasive response on this application is inconsistent with the truthfulness and candor required of a practicing attorney, and may be grounds for a finding by the board of a lack of the requisite candor and fitness for admission to the bar. I find it interesting they require these folks to do this.
Sure, I understand.
And the UW sends a response saying he was terminated. Question, has the applicant ever engaged in fraudulent or deceitful conduct? And they say yes, and that he was informed that he wouldn't be rehired. Now, I suppose from the board's perspective, it may be reasonable to infer that he was evasive when he said that it was low pay and no possibility of promotion.
Well, let me just again return you to what's in Mr. Radke's mind when he fills out the application. He had this 10-minute conference where he essentially said that he wouldn't come back. And then the matter is done. He hears nothing further. He goes on and publishes the paper. Then a few months later, he gets an offer of employment, and he turns it down because he's got a $50,000 book to write, and he's got to do his thesis, and he's got to do all these other things, and he can't earn a living there anyway. Sure, the board can say, well, but I just don't understand why his bearing what was in his mind at the time that he filed this initial application, why there was anything wrong with this, and then when they got the explanation back from UWM, how there was anything wrong with describing what he did, which was accurate. I don't see how that is minimizing conduct. I think you can read Professor Tolliday's critique of the article. The criticism fits exactly with Radke's explanation. And that's the long and the short of this. And I would just like to, if I may take 1 minute, if this court turns down Mr. Radke, who hopefully will find it to be that this one act shouldn't disqualify him, even in the case of people with criminal convictions, you let them apply after 1 year from the date of the board's turn down, not the date that this court makes its decision. But all we're asking for is fairness, and what happened here is not fair and is not right. Thank you, Your Honor.
If your conclusion is wrong, do you want a 1 year, 2 year? What do you think is accepting the board for the moment?
He should be able to apply right away because, as Your Honor pointed out, that that a lot of time has gone by. The board made its decision in December, and this court probably will not decide the case for several months, and we'll have another year gone by right there. And in the Gaylord case and the Singansky case, I believe that's what you did. But
when did you graduate from Marquette?
I think it was
May 98.
Yes. And of course, Dean Eisenberg said that all of this was irrelevant to his law school application, which they poo-pooed.
That's at page 20 of your brief, right?
Chief, may I ask a question?
Justice Prosser.
Without prejudging the case here, if there were a new application, what, Mr. Hilderman, do you think the board is saying about what Mr. Radke should say in that application?
Well, maybe what he should say is use the magic word, I plagiarized, instead of describing what exactly what happened, which is what he did. I don't know.
And if he said that, that would make him a person of good moral character.
I think he is a person of, we have one bad incident in his life, which he described in full, which is in a substantial agreement with what everybody else said about it. I don't know what more he can do. And when this court says that criminals can rehabilitate themselves, he rehabilitated himself from day one when he took responsibility for it. That's what this record shows.
In your view, if he had said, I plagiarized, first time he applied, would he have been accepted?
Well, if he had said that, maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know how the board views plagiarism, but all I can tell you is if you look at the questions, was he disciplined? No. Why did he leave his employment? Low pay, no possibility of promotion. From his perception at the time, based on the 10-minute conference and the subsequent offer of employment, those answers were correct, and then when that was called into question, he gave an accurate explanation. What more can a person do?
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, and thank you for the few extra minutes. I appreciate
before,
it.
Before I close this case, Justice Wilcox will not be participating. That's why the chair is empty. Thank you very much. We have concluded our hearing on 99-0158PA. Ready to call 99-054.